We are continuing the conversation at the Review of Democracy Today. My name is Ferenc Lotso, and it is my special pleasure to be hosting Judith Butler. Welcome to the show, Professor Butler, and thanks so much for accepting our invitation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be in conversation with you.
Amazing to have you. Judith Butler requires no introduction at all, I believe. They are among the best known and most discussed philosophers, gender scholars, and cultural critics in our age, who have exerted a major influence on a host of fields, perhaps most evidently on feminist and queer scholarship. They act as a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and have just published a new book, their first with a trade publisher, under the title Who's Afraid of Gender, which offers an insightful and fascinating read. And I should add that being the platform of the CEU Democracy Institute, the smaller part of the Central European University, which is still active in Budapest, we find the question raised in this title very pertinent, and in fact, all too pertinent. Now, this book critiques what you call the anti-gender ideology movement, Professor Butler, and you argue on its pages that this movement has made gender into a site where intimate fears and anxieties gather and become socially organized. There is a fantasm at the very heart of this movement, you seem to emphasize already early on, and then explain that this anti-gender ideology movement can be understood as a psychosocial phenomenon which uses externalizations, projections, reversals, and so on, and that it is inadvertently confessional, you state. So I wanted us to start by talking about those two points a bit. So why do you interpret this movement as a psychosocial one? And what makes it inadvertently confessional in your view?
Well, first of all, let me say that I am not the one who has coined the term anti-gender ideology movement. This is what they call themselves. So this is a well-established movement with various hubs and networks and financial support, media presences throughout the world. So I'm studying a self-constituted group. And of course, there are different versions and variants of this group with some divergent aims as well. But I think taken as a whole, they do tend to describe gender, the concept, the word, the set of social movements subordinated to the category in their minds as a destructive phenomenon. So one might ask, well, what is it destroying? And if it is destructive, just how destructive is it actually? And some of the things that are said about gender are frankly preposterous. They're not believable. They're not backed up by anything you might read in gender studies. They don't have a basis in what we might understand as gender policy or gender politics more broadly. And yet we hear that gender has the power to destroy man, civilization, that it works either like an Ebola virus or like a nuclear bomb. And some of these quite enlarged phantasms of what gender is, of course, make it quite frightening, and they frighten people who may not be familiar with the term or gender studies or how gender is operating in public policy at this time. So how do you explain a phantasm that is shared and that is produced and circulated for political reasons? On the one hand, it's a phantasm, so it belongs to psychic life. On the other hand, it's serving a social and political function, so it belongs to our social world. We need to be able to move between a psychological or psychoanalytic perspective that delineates the mechanisms of the phantasm, and you mentioned displacement, substitution, externalization, reversal as some of those. At the same time, we don't want just a formal analysis of the phantasm. We want to understand what it's serving, what anxieties it's collecting, what fears it's enlarging, and what desires, even if it's a desire for destruction itself, it is furthering. You ask me about the confessional structure of the phantasm. I suppose when we see that a number of governments claim everyone should be restored to the sex assigned at birth, right? So they're opposed to sex reassignment. They're opposed to trans identity being acknowledged in law or in health services or indeed in educational settings. They're actively involved in stripping trans people of rights, maybe rights they have achieved under some more progressive legal regime, or rights they have achieved through international human rights doctrine or law. They want to take away those rights and say that's not a right, or it should never have been a right. And of course, what they say in justifying themselves is that these gender people, these people who believe in gender, if they get power, they will take your rights away, your rights to your sex identity, which is what Meloni says, your rights to your natal sex, the sex you were assigned at birth. They will all take away those rights. They will take away your family. You won't be able to say mother or father ever again. Well, of course, nobody's doing that. Nobody's doing that. That is a phantasm. Nobody's saying you can't be mother, you can't be father. No one is saying, oh, you were born sex that way. We're going to take that sex assignment away. The only people who are doing that are the people who are trying to deny trans people their right to determine their sex assignment. They want to take that right away. So if I say that this operation is confessional, all I mean is that those who imagine that something called gender will take all your rights away are attributing to gender what they themselves are doing. They are the ones taking rights away.
Thank you so much for that. I think that's a truly outstanding beginning to our conversation. Now, you also argue on these pages that the anti-gender ideology movement renames the object of destruction as its cause and aims at enhancing state power. And a couple of very important political concepts then come into play. You state at one point that fascism names the passions and authoritarianism the emerging, if not accomplished, political reality. So could I ask you, how does this ideology movement draw on what you would call specifically fascist passions? How is it then related to and maybe embedded in new forms of authoritarianism more generally? Let's perhaps take those two questions next.
Yes. Well, I take it that fascist passion can take many forms, but certainly one form is the desire to strip people of their rights, rights of citizenship, rights of self-determination, rights of belonging to a particular country. So if we have the expulsion of migrants with the claim that they don't belong to a particular nation state, if we have the stripping of rights of trans people to determine their own sex, if we have the rights of women to self-determination, including bodily autonomy, taken away, then we're seeing a series of rights stripping activities, not all of which are eliminationist, but some of which I think may well be. So in Florida, we have heard pundits say that trans people should be wiped from the face of the earth. Or in Brazil, among the right-wing evangelicals, we hear, or Catholics, we hear that gender is a devil that must be driven from the land. Now, once people start being identified with gender or in this phantasmatic logic that we've been talking about, they are considered a threat to the nation. And once you are a threat to the nation, whether a terrorist or a devil or an Ebola virus, then whatever measures the state needs to take to drive this threat out, to eliminate this threat, are justified in the name of national security. So oddly, Putin in 2015 thought gender was a matter of national security and a threat to national security. Why? Because the spiritual core of the nation, in his mind, in his discourse at least, was Christian and the Christian doctrine of heterosexual marriage and reproductive sexuality and all the rest. So for him, gender calls into question who can be a parent, whether gay and lesbian parenting is okay, whether gay and lesbian marriage is okay, whether trans rights are admissible, whether representations of progressive social movements, including feminist ones, or ones that call for a separation of church and state. I mean, all of these are threats and can be eliminated as such, either imprisoned, criminalized, or driven from the land. So I do consider those, once people start to believe that there are these threats to the nation, to the family, or even to your sexed identity, your ability to have a family, that they are willing to fight and they're willing to expel or eliminate the groups that are being held accountable for that threat. And I take that to be a stoking of fascist passion. It's one way that minorities or vulnerable communities can be targeted, criminalized, or expelled, sometimes treated with violence that is exonerated in advance by police powers or military powers. And I think we can link migrant communities here with gay, lesbian, queer communities and feminist ones, quite frankly, because there is something going on where these people are being understood as a threat to what is most precious and valuable to the mainstream of the country. And I know you've seen this in Hungary as well. I guess there is, of course, a further point that you mention, which is simply that, you know, every family has its queer uncle or its transgender kid or its gender nonconforming sister or somebody who's, you know, reading the wrong books or interested in films or has an open mind or is affected by material on the internet that makes them quest for more freedom or greater rights of expression. So many of these problems that are being sort of said to emerge with gender or those allied with the idea of gender are actually already inside the family, you know, divorce rates and, you know, people having sex with people who are not from the same racial or religious background, intermarriage, or any number of things are already inside the family, already inside the community. And of course, there are reasons for people to feel a fundamental fear, like, oh, my livelihood, you know, how am I going to make a living? What is my future? Everybody fears now, like, what is the future? Will war ever stop? Will neoliberalism destroy all public and social services? Will any of us be free of debt or of potential criminalization? I mean, we're afraid of ecological catastrophe. We have many things to be afraid of. And it is all too handy, you know, all too quick and easy to say, ah, it's these scholars who are talking about race. It's these scholars who are talking about gender, or it's these public policies that prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, religion, gender, sexuality. It's those anti-discrimination policies. They are what is destroying our community. So I think that the cause of the fear of destruction is misnamed. We have every reason to fear destruction. But for the left, it will become all the more important. And by the left, I mean a kind of radical democratic left. It'll become all the more important to address those fears that people do have and to offer a different kind of vocabulary and a different kind of imaginary one that is, of course, more inclusive and embracing of fundamental democratic values.
Yes, that's a very crucial point. Thank you so much for that. Let us perhaps talk a bit more about how you discuss questions of gender in more theoretical terms on these pages. You explain that the clear dichotomies between nature and culture are actually untenable, and that the material and the social are in fact intertwined in the production of the gendered body, right? That's what you write at some point. And you also propose later on that we should think about gender beyond the logic of property, right? So let us perhaps talk about those two points in turn. So first of all, what do you mean by the material and the social being intertwined? And then what would it mean to think about gender beyond the logic of property?
Mm. Well, I think in some feminist writing, in the, I guess what we call, I don't know, the first or second wave, I always get confused about the waves. I'm not sure I believe in waves. Okay, I guess that's the truth. But in feminist writing in the Anglo-American context, in the 1970s and 80s, there tended to be an assumption that sex belongs to nature and gender is the cultural or social way that a sexed body is organized, or what meanings it comes to have, right? We can't derive the meanings of this sexed body from its biology, but we can acknowledge its biology as natural, and then we can ask about its social organization and what it signifies. I think that that's one thesis that I took up in Gender Trouble in 1990 or late 89, as the case may be. But there was a second thesis as well, which is that even at the level of biology, and biologists are quick to point this out, there are changing frameworks for understanding how to determine sex. Should it be chromosomes? Should it be hormones? Should it be the combination? What about social psychic factors? What about primary and secondary characteristics? What about those who are intersexed, who fall outside the binary, or who have a mixture of attributes, or whose chromosomes are not falling into a clear binary category because there's an extra Y or a broken X? And there are many examples of this. So one question, of course, is what's the interaction between nature over here and the sociocultural world over here? And why do we always imagine them so far apart? Now, there are those who would go back to a form of biological essentialism or insist that biology is causal and that our social forms are simply expressions of our biology. Well, that makes things very easy, but unfortunately, I think it makes them false. And there are others who say, well, maybe our culture and our society produce biology. You know, maybe we're just all, everything is environmentally formed. And well, you could say that, but then you're in the same logic where either one is causal and the other is not, the other is an effect, or the other is causal and the other is an effect. And actually, you know, I think feminist biologists, especially in developmental biology, have proposed ideas of interaction. And we find this as well in a fair amount of work on immunology as well, that these factors do interact with one another, that what we eat enters into our bones, what's prepared in the social and economic world determines to some degree our internal health. We take in toxins and we suffer. We take in air and it either gives us oxygen or it gives us toxins. We, you know, an environmental perspective on these issues would show that many aspects of the human body are deeply affected by the environment. The environment is not just outside, it's also always taken inside through ingestion, through breathing, through the impress of the skin, absorption. So in some ways, as biological creatures, we depend on interaction to live. If there's no food, we're not going to survive. So what is external has to become internal for us to be activated. And it turns out that even testosterone or basic hormones, which we very often refer to in trying to differentiate the sexes, they don't get activated. Testosterone does not get activated except through interaction. So we can't just say, oh, testosterone is internal and biological, and here's the environment over here, which gets affected by testosterone. No, it doesn't even work unless there's an interaction with the environment. So how does that framework change the way we think about sex and gender? It means that what is sexed in us is also, in some sense, the result of interactions. If you say to me, well, somebody who's gone through male puberty is bound to do better on the tennis court than someone who is not, I would say, well, is it true? Not always true, because we do find male athletes with very low testosterone levels who are doing really well on the courts. But also, what if two guys with the relatively same testosterone levels compete, but one of them has had access to a free tennis court his whole life, and the other one has had to pay and struggle and work on a night shift? What are we saying about muscular formation? Muscular formation happens in environments and as an interactive process. So many of our discussions about sex and gender, we think of them strictly as nature and culture or society, I think are mistaken. They belong to older causal models that, frankly, most scientists don't accept anymore.
Now, these are very, very intriguing discussions, and there's obviously will be a lot of discussion and debate, I think, in the coming years, exactly along these lines. Now, another crucial ambition of the book, the way I have read it, is to also think about the problem of racialization and possibilities of decolonization. You aim to place Anglophone scholarship and critical thought on gender in a broader, more global context in this book. So could I ask you what new insights has such a broader contextualization allowed you to develop, and how those insights may in turn then reflect on English language scholarship about gender?
Yes. Well, there are several points to be made here, and I thank you for this question. As you may know, in the US context or in the UK, and also very often in Australia, there are debates between some people who understand themselves as radical feminists and others who are feminists or who are gay, lesbian, or trans activists who don't share the same trans exclusionary convictions of this much more narrow group of feminists, feminists who are not seeking to make strong alliances with these other groups. And in those debates, gender is treated as gender identity. Now, gender is a much broader category, right? We talk about the gender division of labor. We talk about the gender dimensions of public life. We talk about the gender dimensions of war. And we're not talking about gender identity. We're actually talking about forms of power that organize society in certain ways and develop certain ideals of masculinity, according to which governments, policies, cultural representations fashion themselves. So it's a much broader category, gender, than gender identity. But these groups who fight with one another, they don't always have a global perspective. They don't understand how the Christian right, evangelical and Catholic, have developed a discourse against gender, or how anti-gender ideology works in different parts of the world. And in most places, when we think about Brazil or Chile or Argentina, Mexico City, the feminists who are fighting violence against women are also fighting violence against trans people and violence against migrants, because they're against violence, and they're against violence that is perpetrated against vulnerable communities, right? They have a broader principle which allows them to make connections among very different groups. It would be very odd to say, well, I want to protect women assigned female at birth on the streets against violence, but I don't care about the other people who are suffering violence on the street. No, I mean, as a feminist, I would not say that. I mean, I would say everybody who is being attacked on the basis of their gender, their sexuality, whether it's natal or acquired or however it is established or however it's perceived, right? Because you can also be perceived by someone on the street for something you're not. It's not like attackers, you know, define who we are. I mean, their definitions are usually very, very wrong. And the same goes for people who discriminate. They're usually working with prejudice. So my view is that if the Anglo-American crowd were to take in the global movement against gender, they would see that they must make alliances, not just against those who are doing violence on the street, but also against the states and the religious institutions that are trying to shut down the teaching of gender in schools, shut down sex education, restrict the images we can see in arts institutions, taking books out of the library that let children know about the diversity of ways of living and loving in the world, that this is a much broader movement, and that it's part of a new form of authoritarianism, and that we are also, all of us, subject to the fascist passions of hatred and exclusion. We should be bonding together in large, difficult alliances to fight this. So I guess I'm trying to nudge the somewhat provincial global north, the urban centers of the global north. I'm trying to nudge them away from their internecine battles towards a more global perspective. But of course, there's another point here, which is that the Vatican has said that gender is a colonizing ideology. And sometimes people on the religious right, the Christian right in particular, will say that gender is totalitarian. There are German scholars who say that, or that gender is a form of indoctrination or a form of seduction. The seduction charge is another moment that is confessional, right? So if the church says that we are seducing children, and of course we're not, we're trying to teach them to have an open mind and give them things to read and ask them to come up with their own interpretations of what they read, right? That's freedom of inquiry. That's what we do. The church is the one who's now has been, its pedophilia, its abuse of children has been demonstrated to be systematic and absolutely appalling. So that's a moment of externalization that we might say is a hidden confessional. But look, my main point is to say that gender, the gender binary, was imposed by colonial powers. And when the Vatican says, oh, we need to undo this colonization that gender has done, right, for which gender is responsible, what he's really saying is, let's go back to the original missionary colonial position that there are only two genders, that man and woman belong together exclusively in marriage. Marriage should be heterosexual and sexuality should be reproductive in its function. So that's a colonial imposition. What he's objecting to is an idea of gender that questions whether the binary and all that goes with it is as necessary as the Vatican claims. So in fact, to fight the anti-gender ideology movement, we need to take on a decolonial perspective. We also need to see how Christian missionary views of sex, gender, and family have been imposed on Africa. We need to learn a whole lot more about African ways of naming and knowing sex and sexuality that don't conform to the very idea of gender. And we need to be prepared for the fact, as we all should, especially those of us who function in English, for other ways of approaching this topic that don't necessarily even use the word gender, right? We need to see that there are languages that inflect gender differently or don't use that word or have ways of referring to people in their relationships with one another or what they do that doesn't translate into sex assignment or gender identity in the way that many people who are arguing in the urban centers of the global north are not always aware of.
Thank you so much. In closing, I also wanted to ask you a couple of questions in connection with what you have just been talking about. The book shows that the anti-gender ideology movement can figure gender as Marxist or as capitalist, as tyranny, as libertarianism, as a colonizing force, or as an unwanted migrant. And all of this is blatantly self-contradictory, of course. And you show that these discourses use a kind of associative logic, right? And they slide between premise and conclusion, as you put it on these pages. And in a sense, their aim is to foreclose thought. And very much on the contrary, you wish to enable thinking, to open up categories, and to foster radical imaginings, one might say. And you state that you're in favor of broad alliances, right? That would reflect the interdependency of all human and non-human life, that would oppose climate destruction and stand for what you call a radical democracy informed by socialist ideals, right? I found these very important statements in the book. So again, let us talk about those quite big subjects. So first of all, would you say that a radical democracy amounts to a permanent exercise in thinking and in imagining? and that authoritarianism and fascism are dangerous forms of refusing to think and refusing to imagine. Is that how you would, how you would think about it? And then what would it take to support and to really foster these broad alliances to have such permanent exercises?
Yes. Well, I would say that democracies only thrive when there is support for education based on the idea of open inquiry, and where universities in particular are understood to have open critical inquiry as the core of their mission. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that we have to be able to question the presuppositions that we have accepted in our lives or that have come down to us from various authorities. We need to be able to adjudicate among the values that we find most important and those that we think are in fact harmful to our world, whether the human world, the ecological world, the animal world. We need to be able to form value judgments and to base our conclusions on evidence and good reasoning. So that's what I mean by open inquiry, free and open inquiry. It's not a radical skepticism, really, but it is questioning in the service of clarifying values and trying to figure out what kind of world we want to make, what kind of world do we want to live in, what is hurting this world, what could repair this world, all of those questions. And different disciplines, I think, approach those questions quite differently. And I would say all of them are actually needed, especially now when so much of what we value most in life feels imperiled. The anti-gender ideology movement is one among many anti-intellectual movements. They make fun of universities. They consider that we're either completely obscure, nobody can understand us. It's one reason I wrote a trade book. It's like, all right, here I am talking to you. Listen up. I don't think there are any cruel and unusual sentences in this book. Maybe a few. Okay, just a few. But for the most part, I'm talking to people who don't necessarily have the same education that I do and who may well be confused. Like, what is it that I'm hearing about gender and what do I think about it? But perhaps most importantly, the attack on intellectual life is an attack on critical thought, on asking whether what the church says is right, what the state says is right. How do we develop an independent view? How do we form a judgment? So this is a question of freedom of thought that I think is really quite important. And sadly, we are often accused of indoctrination, but it's precisely doctrine that we're not taking for granted. It's precisely those doctrines that we've been told are the ones we must accept, including the natural law thesis that there's only male and female, and that the two belong together in sexuality and love and marriage, and that that's the only way things can be. So when we start asking whether that's necessary and true, we're not saying, oh, let's destroy the heterosexual family. We're just saying, well, there are other ways. There are other ways, and we can live together. We can cohabit on this earth in different ways of making family or kinship or community, and they should be equally valuable. And that's not going to actually hurt anyone to live in a state of equality with others. I suppose I also just need to say that the contradictory character of the anti-gender ideology movement is very exciting for some people, because if you don't need to have a clear argument in order to accept what the anti-gender people are saying, then you might respond to one part of it and not to the other, or you might respond to all of it and not worry whether it comes together. It may be that your fear of capitalism and your fear of totalitarianism come together, and it's like gender is responsible for both. It meets an emotional need. It may even create an emotional need without accountability to reason, to logic, to evidence, to documentation. So in that way, it's against thought, and it's against the kind of thought that's necessary for democracy. And although some people would say, oh, gender, that's some identitarian politics, or that's a secondary or tertiary problem. That's not the real problem. Gender is right now a prism through which we can see a massive crisis in democracy, because once you start on the road to censorship, expulsion, rights stripping, anti-intellectualism, the tearing at universities and free thought within universities, you're on your way towards an authoritarian regime that does not value democracy. So gender is right there at the center of all of our debates, or should be, on the crisis of democracy today.
I think that's a very strong note to perhaps end on. Thank you so much for that precise and illuminating response, and for the entire conversation today, Judith Butler.
Okay, Ference, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
The pleasure has been all mine. I have been discussing with Judith Butler, who has just made another essential intervention with their new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? I hope you have enjoyed our conversation apropos this exciting new publication. Until the next conversation here at the Review of Democracy.